This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. June 4th, 1965, President Lyndon Johnson gave an historic commencement speech at Howard University.
Johnson spoke directly about what would eventually become known as affirmative action. He told the graduates of the historically black college that African Americans were still living with the legacy of slavery. It was not enough for the nation, he said, to tell them, quote, you are free to compete with all the others and believe that that was completely fair.
It is not enough just to open the gates of opportunity. All our citizens must have the ability to walk through those gates. And this is the next and the more profound stage of the battle for civil rights. We seek not just freedom, but opportunity. We seek not just legal equity, but human ability. Not just equality as a right and a theory, but equality as a fact and equality as a result.
Affirmative action, especially in higher education, has been in and out of the courts multiple times since Johnson gave that speech almost 50 years ago. Quotas have been thrown out, but using race as a limited factor in admissions has remained in use and legal so far.
This October, the Supreme Court is scheduled to hear a case that could throw out any and all race-conscious admissions policies, effectively ending affirmative action in higher education.
That possibility has alarmed more than 100 colleges and universities around the country. A dozen of them are among the most elite in the land. MIT, Harvard, Brown, Dartmouth, and Yale have all filed a brief in support of affirmative action, saying it's essential to achieve campus diversity that they believe is critical to an effective 21st century education.
Others say, call it what you will, race-conscious admissions policies are still just racist. So we're going to dive into this latest and perhaps most decisive court case right now. We'll hear in a moment from the MIT Dean of Admissions and an advocate who'd like to see the High Court do away with affirmative action. But first, Peter Schmidt, senior writer for the Chronicle of Higher Education and author of Color and Money, How Rich White Kids Are Winning the War Over College Affirmative Action. He's been following the court cases on affirmative action for many, many years. Peter Schmidt, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Oh, thank you. Glad to be here.
So first, briefly, if you could outline us this latest case that the Supreme Court will be hearing in October. It's Fisher versus the University of Texas. So what's at issue here?
Okay, the case involves a lawsuit filed against the University of Texas at Austin by Abigail Fisher, who was a white applicant who was rejected in 2008. And the lawsuit alleges that Texas is considering race in admissions when it doesn't need to. The University of Texas is unusual among selective colleges in the United States, although not necessarily unusual among selective colleges in Texas, in that it's affected by a state law requiring it to admit any high school graduate from the state in the top 10% of their class. The state law was passed in an effort to promote diversity on campus. A couple years ago, the state amended the law to let Texas cap at 75% the number of students who got in through this policy. But nevertheless, the policy has resulted in a significant amount of diversity at the University of Texas, more diversity than was present at the University of Michigan when the courts visited this case, or visited this issue, I'm sorry, in 2003. And the lawsuit is essentially saying Texas has all the diversity it needs. It does not need to be considering race in dealing with the applicants that it does not get in under the Texas 10% plan. And the court has, or the case has ended up in the Supreme Court.
So, Peter Schmidt, I hear what you're saying about the specifics of Texas state law and that 10% plan and how this Fisher case challenges that directly. But why is it that so many educators and people, you know, interested in higher education are looking at this case as one that could potentially, you know, depending on how the court decides, you know, do away with all racial factors, large and small, in higher education admissions policies?
Well, Fisher's lawyers and several conservative advocates who have filed friend of the court briefs with the Supreme Court and at the lower court levels are urging the court to go back and look at its 2003 decision, which had said that colleges had reaffirmed that colleges can consider to use can continue to consider race for educational diversity purposes. It had said that colleges should give good faith consideration to race-neutral alternatives. And anyway, these conservative advocates are saying to the court, you know, the 2003 decision was a mistake. If you give the colleges an inch, they'll take a mile. And the courts need to be doing much more, at least to be doing much more to oversee colleges to make sure that they are narrowly tailoring these policies. But potentially the court needs to just throw out the 2003 precedent.
Mm. So we are in 2012 now. The court obviously has quite a different makeup than it did in 2003 when, as you've mentioned, that University of Michigan case, Grutter versus Bollinger, as you said, still allowed for some use of racial preferences or racial considerations in admissions. Is there any sense amongst legal watchers that you've been speaking with on how they think? I mean, I always know it's dangerous to try and prognosticate what the court might do, but, you know, how this case might go.
Sure. All eyes are on Anthony Kennedy. Justice Kagan has recused herself from hearing this case, so the case will be heard by 8 members of the court. Among those 8 members, there's 4 reliable conservatives who would have ruled against Grutter basically in 2003, Roberts, Scalia, and Thomas. On the other side, Breyer, Ginsburg, and Sotomayor are likely to embrace race-conscious admissions. Kennedy, when the Michigan cases were decided, had agreed with the idea that race-conscious admissions serve a compelling government interest, but he had serious objections to the University of Michigan's policy and thought the court had – this was the law school policy there in Grutter – and thought the court had not given it nearly enough scrutiny. Mm. There's some chance that this time around he will rethink his logic then and say that the court should not have embraced the use of race-conscious admissions in 2003. There's also a chance that he will say that the court needs to be overseeing colleges much more and when it comes to this issue. Part of what is at work here is you have a body of jurisprudence, body of court precedents saying that race-conscious policies of any sort deserve strict court scrutiny. You also have a body of precedents coming out of cases during the Cold War in the 50s and 60s, which say that the ability to admit students is a key academic freedom that colleges have, the ability to choose how to admit their students, and which lumps academic freedom in with other First Amendment rights. So the question of how much autonomy colleges should have will be at issue here. And that's one key reason other colleges such as Harvard care about this case.
Right. So let's listen. Let's hear if we can in a moment from representatives of one of those other colleges. But Peter Schmidt, stand by for a second if you can, because I want to also just throw a couple questions out to our listeners who are hearing this, because what do you think, listeners, about the fact that colleges and universities, many of the elite ones in our region here, may use race as one factor to consider when admitting students? What do you make of the fact that affirmative action has once again made its way to the United States Supreme Court? Have we reached a point in this country where affirmative action is no longer necessary? Or maybe we're not quite there yet. And do you think that this argument about campus diversity being a fundamental aspect of an excellent 21st education is a good one? And beyond that, do you think affirmative action is helping or preventing maybe the educational system from solving the inequities in K-12 education before students even get there? What are your thoughts about affirmative action in higher ed? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-8255. talk. You can also comment online at Radio Boston. As you heard, I'm speaking with Peter Schmidt. He's senior writer for the Chronicle of Higher Education. And joining us now is Stuart Schmill. He's the Dean of Admissions at MIT. Dean Schmill, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much.
Also with us is Roger Clegg. He is president and CEO of the Center for Equal Opportunity. And he and the center have filed a brief in support of Abigail Fisher, and that is the young woman who is suing the University of Texas for use of affirmative action in the case that will be in front of the court in October. Roger Clegg, welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
So, Dean Schmill, let's start with you. How does MIT consider race or use race in its admissions process?
Well, thank you, first of all, for including me in this conversation. It's a really important case and a really important issue, and that's because diversity is absolutely critical for us to be able to carry out our educational mission. Students learn an enormous amount from each other, and in a diverse environment is absolutely necessary for to prepare them for the world today. In fact, students really understand this, and it's one of the things that our students really deeply appreciate and love about MIT is the diverse environment. Mm-hmm. Meghna, I remember the summer after my sophomore year in high school, many decades ago. I grew up in New York City in Queens, and I attended a program, a summer program, that was funded by the National Science Foundation on the campus of Wichita State University. So here I was, this kid who had never been out of Queens, except maybe for a trip up to the Catskills, but never been out of Queens. And I went to this program, a math program in Kansas, and I learned with students from all over the country. And there were students who had grown up in the wheat fields of Kansas and potato farms in Idaho. And that program was one of the most transformational experiences that I'd ever had. It wasn't about the math, because I'd taken math programs in Queens as well, but it was the chance to live and learn with and from students from different backgrounds that made it so valuable.
So, Roger Clegg, you hear what Stuart Schmill is saying. It's essentially, he's echoing the same argument that the colleges put forth in their amicus brief to the court, that using race as a consideration in admissions is what helps these colleges and universities create a diverse campus, which then allows them to create an excellent educational environment. What's your thought or response to that?
Well, first of all, you have to bear in mind always that what we're talking about here is racial discrimination. The question is whether the good things that we get from various kinds of diversity justify something as ugly as treating people differently on the basis of skin color and what country their ancestors came from. You can admit students based on them providing a diversity of backgrounds and perspectives, which is what Stuart was talking about, without using skin color and national origin as a proxy for people having a particular background or perspective.
Let me ask you a quick question about that, because MIT, Harvard, these elite schools, for example, they may have a different set of considerations than some of the large public universities. And Dean Schmill, correct me if I'm wrong, but a school like MIT has something like 8,000 applicants annually for 18,000, I should say, for a mere 1,000 spots. You know, many, many thousands of those students are all equally qualified. So you still have to cull that group down to a mere thousand. What other basis would you have a university choose amongst all these equally qualified candidates?
Are you asking?
Yeah, Roger Clegg, I'm just curious what you think about that.
Well, I think there are a variety of things that you can use, but one thing that you should not use is skin color. And, you know, you can look, of course, at SAT scores and grades and things like that. And by the way, you know, this notion that you hear sometimes that, oh, well, you know, they're all equally qualified and we're just using race as a tiebreaker is false. At the University of Texas, for instance, you know, the difference in SAT scores in the group of students that we're talking about varied by 200 points, you know, between, you know, blacks and whites, and was even a greater margin between blacks and Asians. So, you know, you can look at geography, you can look at socioeconomic status, you can look at, you know, where they went to school, what their extracurricular activities were, teacher recommendations, all the things that MIT, you know, looks at. I have no problem with any of that, but they should not be engaging in racial discrimination.
Okay, let me turn that back to Stuart Schmill. If you use these other factors, as Roger Clegg was pointing out too, and not looked at race, would you not be able to achieve the same degree of campus diversity that you're aiming for?
Well, that's right, but I first want to just respond to the fact that certainly at MIT, it is absolutely not true, and I think a common misconception, but not true, that we are admitting some students who are less qualified than others. As you mentioned, Meghna, we do have over 18,000 applications for about 1,000 students in the class, and I would say about 14,000 of those 18,000 applicants are well qualified for MIT, and about 10,000 of them are so well qualified that we would be excited to have any one of them. And we have to make choices about whom of those 10,000 students we're going to pick to join our class. And it's a false notion that we could take those 10,000 students and line them up and order them from the best applicant to the worst applicant.
Well, look, you can order them any way you like, but why are you using skin color? You know, you can, you know, maybe you can't line them all up, but rather if it's really true, and I don't think it is, that you can't rank them at all, then you should flip a coin rather than
flipping a coin. Do you not think that would lead schools like MIT to also end up in court because of the arbitrary nature of that?
No,
I mean, Roger Clegg, I am curious. I am curious. You say it's just why use skin color. Does that mean that you object to the notion that we heard, you know, President Lyndon Johnson say back in 1965 that there are historical hangovers from the choices that the United States made as a country regarding its treatment of certain races that have led to centuries long of, you know, what we've seen as correlations between race and income, race and educational attainment, race and socioeconomic mobility? Do you believe those correlations no longer exist in the 21st century, in 2012 America?
What Lyndon Johnson was talking about was a remedial justification, you know, what lawyers would call a remedial justification for considering race and ethnicity. That is not the argument that MIT is making. And the reason that they're not making that argument is because the Supreme Court has rejected it. And they rejected it for a very good reason, which is that in 2012, you cannot use race as a proxy for socioeconomic disadvantage. Yes, there are African Americans who are poor and who may be able to trace their poverty somehow or other to slavery. But most of the students who get into MIT who are African American do not come from poor, disadvantaged backgrounds. And there are plenty of white kids and Asian kids who come from poor and disadvantaged backgrounds. Let me point out that more and more in America in 2012, what we're talking about is discriminating against Asian kids in favor of Hispanic kids. Now, what's the historic justification for that?
Well, on the other hand, we've seen in states such as California, which so often serves as a petri dish for social issues in the United States, when California's Prop 209 came along and they banned all affirmative action. In fact, what happened was Asian American students ended up dominating admissions in places like the University of California at Berkeley.
Do you have a problem with that?
No, I don't. I'm just.
I don't either.
Although some other students may have a problem with that. I'm just bringing it up as an example, but I do want to turn back to Stuart Schmill for a second and actually talk to you a little bit more about this California example. I mean, there are people who said that it shows us what would happen. I mean, California is not the only one, for example. There are other states, including New Hampshire and Washington State and several others, that whether via the ballot box or state-based legislation have done away with affirmative action. Just respond to what Roger Clegg was saying and say, what would you prognosticate would happen to the MIT student body if indeed you weren't able to use race at all?
Well, again, I want to make very clear that race is one of many factors that we're considering when we are trying to build a diverse class. It's one of many. And if we think about those 10,000 students who are all excellent and we would be excited to have any one of them, and so this is not an ordering that we're admitting a student who is less capable or less able than another, But what we're trying to do is build a class that is equally able and yet diverse in all of its backgrounds. If we were not able to consider race, I think we would have a less racially diverse undergraduate body, and I think our education, therefore, would be diminished.
But on the other hand, I mean, in 2012, the United States Census Bureau reported that for the first time amongst infants born in the United States, more than 50% of them were members of minority groups. Mm-hmm. That's a first for the history of the United States. Is it possible that regardless of what the law does, 18 years from now, just the sheer nature of who's applying to your schools, not just like MIT, but across the country, is going to render this entire conversation moot? Is that possible?
Well, it's possible. But if you look at the K through 12 system, which I know we talked about a little bit earlier, that hasn't necessarily produced equal outcomes. I mean, there still is a gap, a racial achievement gap, not a talent gap, of course, but an achievement gap that our school system has been producing. And so your question is whether or not that is going to go away in 18 years. Yes, it's possible. I'm not optimistic about it. And I think perhaps I wonder if Peter, who has done a lot of thinking about this issue as well. But I think the key thing to remember here is that we are assembling a class. Our ability to assemble a class that is diverse in all ways is what's very important to us.
Roger Clegg, let me get your response to that, because I know you've, in writing that you've done, for example, in the National Review, you've pointed to exactly this, that the demographics of the United States are changing such that you see that as justification for the removal of affirmative action laws.
Well, exactly, and I think it not only justifies it, but it makes it essential, because when you have a country that is as racially diverse as the United States and is becoming increasingly racially diverse, and where individual Americans are more and more likely to check more than one racial box, we can't have a legal regime that sorts Americans according to skin color and what country their ancestors came from, and treats some people better and other people worse on that basis. Let me say that the reason that we have these racial disparities now in 2012, and this is not a popular thing to say, but the reason that we have these racial disparities now is not principally because of discrimination. It's because of the fact that 72% of African Americans now are born out of wedlock, versus fewer than 2 out of 10 Asian Americans and fewer than 3 out of 10 whites.
Oh, let me get Peter Schmidt back in here. We've just got one, maybe even 30 seconds to go. I'm sorry that I didn't bring you into this conversation sooner. But your last thought on what you've heard so far, this sounds like we actually, when it comes to talking about affirmative action in America, I hate to say it, but it doesn't sound like we've made a lot of progress.
Well, in response to the comments made so far, if we're going to get diversity at colleges without race-conscious admissions, we need to reform K-12 education, and colleges need to change their admission processes so that they're not rewarding students based on cash and connections. Colleges have a lot of advantages, or a lot of criteria that advantage wealth and deciding admissions, and that works against diversity as well.
Peter Schmidt is a senior writer for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Thank you so much for joining us today. And Roger Clegg, president and CEO of the Center for Equal Opportunity, thank you as well. And Stuart Schmill, dean of admissions at MIT, pleasure to have you as well.
My pleasure. Thank you.
There's more Radio Boston coming up. Stick with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.